It's tough to come up and talk after such a lively ending. I like that, the subsidized tickets. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. I want to thank first the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and the New England Policy Center and the Kennedy Center Rappaport Institute and the Taubman Center for inviting me. It's good to be here, and I'm really pleased to have an opportunity to talk on this topic. It's very important. And you've heard from two of our leading thinkers on this. Both Paul and Ed are, they're super researchers, great scholars, and think hard about these things. And they're also both quite entertaining presenters. So from an academic perspective, this is a treat. And then Alicia, thank you so much for the setup, because I think it really helps to provide the context for some of the things I want to say. I thought I'd start by stepping back a little bit and really provide some context for how we're thinking about this and what the goals are. President Rosengren, when he spoke this morning, noted that it took two decades for Japan to get out of their real estate morass. For us, that's too long, and I hope that you share that viewpoint. We really do need to think hard about how we stabilize the market and get it back to a functional perspective. And some of the proposals that he suggested in terms of resolving the REO process on REO properties are important in that. There's also a policy context that I wanted to just lift up, which is that this foreclosure crisis, the housing crisis, it's not a generalized experience. This is an experience that has hit particular neighborhoods and particular communities very hard and has been quite devastating to them. You can think about a lot of our lower income neighborhoods and homeowners. It's taken them decades, or in some cases decades, to get to a place where they could own a home. That's been wiped out. The Deputy Secretary at HUD, Ron Sims, when he talks about housing markets and this housing process, he describes this as the removal or the elimination of our minority middle class, that we have a lot of minority households, a lot of minority communities, that we're relying on household as that stepping stone. All that is gone, or much of it is gone. And so when we think about this, this really has real social and economic implications that run deep, and they run deep to some of our most vulnerable populations, and that has implications for all of us. The second point I wanted to highlight was really something that Alicia alluded to, which is that when we think about the housing crisis, it's not just one crisis. There is incredible diversity in the experiences and what led to difficulties in particular places. So you can think about, I'm from Los Angeles. The experience in Los Angeles was bad. The experience in San Bernardino, which is about an hour east of Los Angeles, was much worse. That's a suburban community. Largely people, you've heard the phrase drive to qualify. A lot of that it has a very specific character. You can compare that with Las Vegas. So Las Vegas and LA, not the same in any regard. Well, maybe in some regards, but really different markets and things that drive them. You can compare that with Cleveland. Now, Cleveland's had a foreclosure problem for a long time, for a decade. Right, it's gotten worse in this episode, but Cleveland's marketplace is quite different. And then you have Boston, right? So we have four different models of what the foreclosure crisis looks like, what housing difficulty looks like. So when we think about causes, it's going to be difficult to have some broad brush explanations for what underlies those things. What I thought I would do is take on some of the comments that both Paul and Ed made to, discuss into an econ world. They're supposed to find something interesting to say, to push for further work. But I then wanted to talk a bit about the need for policy and end with a bit on expectations, because both previous papers talked about the importance of expectations, both on the buyer side and on the investor side. I think that's exactly right. And I want to talk a bit about what we all do to help shape those expectations, and how we might work to sort of get to a different place in what people expect from their housing. All right, so starting with Paul. Paul had a lot of really compelling data and information, which does to a large extent, debunk sort of the bad lender story, that this is a bunch of predatory folks that are hiding information and not making loan details known. And we had large groups of people who were uninformed and unprepared for what these products were supposed to do. I think that in general, as a meta story, as a high-level story, that's right. I do wonder, though, that I have a concern that while there may not have been a lack of information out there, getting that information to the right people so that they were fully informed, and then even when they had the information, did they use it in a meaningful way? I'm not really sure. Well, I have concerns as to whether that really happened. And in that regard, you know, when I talk about this, I really talk about the episode as a remarkable lack of due diligence on the part of just about everyone in the system. So we had borrowers with no due diligence, we had banks, we had investors, the rating agencies, which we haven't mentioned, play a huge role in this, and everyone looked to someone else to validate the rationality of their decision. And their decision was always to go. So there were very few parties in this mortgage origination change and the housing finance change that had an incentive to say no, so nobody did. And there was a tremendous passing of the buck in that regard. I would also say that part of this has to do with herd mentality and the speed of transactions. So technology has actually changed how people view what people view a reasonable amount of due diligence is. And I've heard it said that in Wall Street, the challenge is, or the concern is not to lose money. So whether you lose money is not a problem. It's if you're the only one who loses money, that's the problem. So if someone else is out there doing something and they're making money in the short run, you're going to see everybody run to that. And that 11 p.m. call from the CEO to a manager, you know, I just saw, or probably a 6 a.m. call saying, I saw that, you know, our competitor did this and they made, you know, $10 billion. Why aren't we doing that? That's real. And the being left out, I think, creates some pressures. I would also, I agree completely with Paul's point that virtually all of the products in the marketplace were not new. Right? These were all things that had been around for decades. There was something that was new, though, and that was who was getting the product and who was using these products. And I don't think we should overlook the fact that through this period, we really saw a shift in who had access to particular types of products. And that led to different performance profiles as we moved forward. And you know, Paul actually showed the profiles. So the 2005 book performance versus the 2006 and 7 book performance was striking, remarkable, and actually known by many. What was interesting, though, is that in going from 05 to 06, we saw a change in performance. Going from 06 to 07, we basically saw the same crappy performance. We did not see comparable changes in the pricing of those securities. Right? So we really did see the market having this information out there and not really responding in ways that we would have expected a well-functioning market to respond. To me, that was quite interesting to see that and to actually reflect upon that, and it's something that should cause all of us pause. The other thing I just wanted to say on the securities is that there was information out there. I don't think it was as clear and as easy to use as Paul suggested. So I've been on that Edgar website pulling down the securities information. Go do that, right? So I would encourage all of you to go and pull down information about a security. It is not obvious. It's not straightforward. You need PhDs to go through and actually be able to make an informed decision about whether the pricing and the bundling of these loans makes sense. So I do think that there are still some challenges and there's not full transparency in what the information means, even if you have access to it. In terms of Ed's paper, the interest rate issue is clear, and I think that's right. I do think that there are concerns about who's actually using the products, though, right? So we have products and product attractiveness, particularly these Alt-A products with the teaser rates or the subprime. They are a function of interest rates. And so if we're trying to roll out these interest rate-sensitive products to new populations that have not perhaps been sensitive to that. There is the potential that that combined dynamic can get people into ownership situations who maybe wouldn't have been there before, or wouldn't be there otherwise, and that can exacerbate the problem that we have. So that interaction, I think, is something that we have to be concerned about. And I would just say, you know, in the 90s, I worked at the board in Washington, and in those years, you know, Alt-A product, subprime product, they weren't really out there, right? They were very niche, very fringe, and we were just starting to pay attention to them. In the 2000s, subprime and Alt-A were king, right? Everybody ran into these markets. Who got exposed to them? Their use and their leverage was pretty significant. To the extent that these are interest rate sensitive products, low interest rates are actually going to be part of the story. They may not be the main part of the story, but they're a key piece. And I do also think that two other things in this context we have to think about. Ed talked about leverage. I think leverage is really important, and we did see an increase in household leveraging. And you could also think of the 2000s episode as sort of the exposure of leverage as a poor strategy. So if you look thinking about investment banks and their collapse, almost all the ones that collapsed first and most spectacularly had very high leverage strategies. We're seeing the same thing on the homeowner side. And then we haven't talked a lot about this, but how people funded mortgages also was important. So we had a lot of second mortgages that started to be introduced that allowed for a masking of how much risk and how much leverage was actually being taken. And a lot of first mortgage lenders kind of discovered that after the fact. The last point I wanted to say on Ed's paper is that the supply story that he talks about, that may be true in Boston, it may be true in Los Angeles, San Francisco, that's almost certainly not the story in San Bernardino. It's not the story in suburban Sacramento. So for one part of our foreclosure housing crisis story, that's not going to be part of the story. So we're going to have to think about how these things fit together. All right, so in both of these presentations, there was a clear discussion that there is a need for policy, and that policy is particularly important. When I think about policy, and I would, you know, being in the government, clearly I hold a similar view, I think that we really have to think about two things. One is institutional design, and how do we set up structures so that we can perhaps put boundaries on the possibilities for excess. And then the second is actually what do we do in terms of the policies, in terms of availability, in terms of incentives that are put in place for borrowers and households to get into home ownership. I do think that we do need pretty strongly, we need to take pretty strong actions to increase incentives for thorough due diligence. You'll see this in the proposal that's currently out there about getting more skin in the game, to perhaps try to get someone somewhere in that chain to say, well, maybe this isn't a good idea and I don't want to be part of it. Those incentives clearly were not strong enough in this context, and I think we want to do that. I also think that the regulatory structure and those incentive changes need to happen at all parts of the chain. So, you know, Paul in his chart talked about borrowers, mortgage bankers, investment banks, and lenders. I think there are things that need to happen in all of those buckets if we're going to get to a more rationalized system. And that's a big task, and you haven't heard the last word on this. This is going to be years and years of conversation and policymaking. This will not happen in just a couple of months. The second thing is I think we should think hard about products and what types of products preferences we might want to have. Now, when I talk about product preferences, I'm not really in favor of banning products per se, but we may want to think about making some products harder to get access to or making people go through more of a process to get access to some products. Many like the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That has a lot of nice features. It's not going to be the right product for everyone, but if we're going to get into a different type of product, or if people are going to get into it, we might have an interest in making sure that they really understand the risks that are associated with that. Okay, so the last thing and on that last point, which will get me to expectations, I do think that we need to, you know, if you take an economic model, we assume there are many buyers and sellers and that they all have all the information you possibly need, right? This is a full information marketplace. I think it's hard to argue that that's where we are today. And I think that there are shortcomings in a host of areas. I'm going to focus my remarks on borrowers mainly, but when we think about this misplacing of expectations and these faulty expectations, I think that we really do need to think about, well, what do our consumers know? What do the investors know about how housing markets function? What do borrowers and households know about this, and what can we do about it? So Ed asked a question, and I agree with this question completely, which is, where do these expectations come from? I mean, as economists, you know, we like numbers, we like sort of buying and selling and bartering, but expectations are hard to reconcile. They're hard to explain, and so this is sort of, we're moving into non-econ territory here. But it's important for us to really consider as we move forward. What is clear is that expectations did shift, and for many this meant that they were taking actions with pretty much of a limited idea of how much real risk they were taking on, because the expectations had clouded their notion of reality. I'm going to offer three possible places where expectations arise from, and maybe you guys will have others as we go through the conversation. The first is by watching others, right? So the idea that my neighbor did something, it worked well for them. My cousin did something, it worked well for them. They've been doing this for years and years. They've made a lot of money. Maybe that's the norm for that marketplace. You hear a lot of conversation about that today, actually, in fact, when we talk about foreclosures. So I was at a conference last week where people were suggesting that there's a concern that more and more people are going to start walking away from the home, right? As soon as the first person does it, their neighbor's going to see that it's been done, so they're going to do it, the next person. And so that can create sort of a norm of behavior and a norm of activity and action, which effectively becomes sort of a market expectation. A second source of expectations, I think, are broader societal cues. All three speakers spoke a little bit about this in terms of, you know, investment motive for housing versus consumption motive. I would just say that in the last 15 years, we have seen a tremendous reshaping of our social cues around what is the value of a house. So 10, 15 years ago, flipping a house was considered predatory lending. I went to conferences and predatory, you know, if you flip. Now we have TV shows called Flip That House, right? We have a fundamental shift that's happened at a broad social level around what housing is supposed to do and how it's to be accomplished, and that shapes expectations as well. So if we're going to flip a house, that says some things about what we expect to happen in terms of house price trajectories. That's critical, and that's all of us, right? So we all have a part to play in this. The third point of expectations, I think, has to do with just basic education and basic knowledge, right? So there are going to be some instances where you see your neighbor do something, and you know enough to know that that's a crazy thing. I'm not doing that. That's crazy. Or you see someone flip a house, and you say, well, that's really risky, right? That might not work out, right? In this instance, we didn't see as much of that as we might have. And to me, that says that we've had a broad failing in terms of making sure that people are equipped with enough information to make independent assessments about these things. Paul mentioned that, you know, the Fed's response was a brochure, right? Probably not enough. The question is, what is enough? What do we need to do and put in place to make sure that third source of expectations is one that actually influences and binds those other things that go on and limits how many people are going to get into situations that can get them into significant trouble. I have a whole soapbox speech on that. I will spare you that for today, but I do think it's something we all need to reflect on. And the last thing I wanted to say is really talk about rental housing. So when we think about housing policy, oftentimes it's couched in terms of home ownership policy, and they're really talked about as they're interchangeable. They're not, and in fact, we have a de facto rental policy because we don't talk about it, right? So things happen, things kind of evolve. That also sends a message. So as we think about, you know, home ownership, as we think about what a well-functioning housing market looks like, we need to think explicitly about, well, how does the rental market work? How does it relate to the ownership market? And what things can we do to smooth transitions from ownership to rental and from rental to ownership? Right now, you know, the low-income housing tax credit is not working very well. We're not providing affordable rental housing in any meaningful way. This, the supply issues that Ed talks about, if we're going to add to supply, we've got to make sure that we have a system that allows us to build multifamily housing in a consistent way that responds to market demands. So for me, the last thing I wanted to say is in all of this, I talk about rental because I feel like we've got to think about, do we have a balance in our messaging around ownership housing versus rental housing? And for us, I think the goal is to get people to think, am I being well housed? And if you think in terms of being housed well rather than being a homeowner, I think we can start to have different sorts of conversations and have people reach different outcomes, which will leave them less exposed and leave our communities and our neighborhoods in a much stronger and better place. So thank you very much, and I look forward to conversation.